Okay, so for those who are not so familiar with us, my name is Cynthia Chung, and I'm the president for the Rising Tide Foundation. It's a nonprofit in Montreal. We come from Montreal, and basically, it's an educational platform, but also focuses on history and cultural works, and ultimately is to bridge the West and the East to show the things that we have in common in terms of the best teachings. And for us to not only remember our best teachings in the past, but to be connected with those on the other side of the globe and see how everything is actually in harmony when we're at our best and those sorts of things. So my class is again, a continuation. I like the title so much too. So I just used it as well for the title of my class, From Templar to Jesuits, the Occult Underground Shaping World History. I'm glad that Matt went over a lot because it's going to make my job easier, but I'll talk a little bit too about the Knights Templar. So they arose out of the Crusades in 1118 within Jerusalem, whose headquarters were at the Temple Mount. And the Templars were French military order of the Catholic faith. Also, to make a note, Matt leaving off on the Venetian Empire is very important for people. And I'm going to have more of a focus on the Vatican and the Jesuits in my presentation. That Venice actually played a huge role in basically coming into the Vatican. They had a lot of Venetian Catholic cardinals, and they played a major role in shaping the Protestant-Catholic War in Germany. But that's a story for another day, but people can find information, more information on that on my Substack through Glass Darkly. They can check out a presentation called Ghost Seer, which is based off of a book by Friedrich Schiller. So the Templars, their French characteristics of monk warrior, yada yada. We don't have to say too much. They had commanderies, which were districts under the control of the commander of Order of Knights. And I don't think we need to talk too much about that. The Templars were the first corporation. That's a very important point. Their temple church was built in London in 1185, would serve as London's first bank, which would also be pretty much the first bank of the Vatican as well, you can say. And I'll talk more about what would be the modern form of the Vatican Bank later on. So that was the thought, was one way to transport the loot, because unfortunately the loot was a big factor in the Crusades and not so much, spreading good teachings or morality or anything like that. It's very important to note that the Templars, as a first corporation, would have a similarity to what the Jesuits would later form as in service to the Vatican, and then you'd have the Vatican Bank and the City of London. They all have pretty much the similarity in how they run the show. Yeah, so this system allowed for the Templars to travel without having to carry all their immense wealth with them. They could voyage over great distances without having to carry all of that coin, and they could deposit it or take it out from their Templar bank based in Jerusalem. This image is one of the St. John's Co-Cathedral skeleton tombstones located in Valletta, Malta. So this is where the Knights of Malta ended up having their headquarters. The floor of this Baroque sanctuary is covered in memento mori. The story of these cadavers is inextricably linked with the history of the Order of Knights of the Hospital St. John of Jerusalem, aka the Knights Hospitaller. And in 1530, the Knights were given permanent headquarters on Malta. And this was given by the King of Spain. The King of Spain gave them this. There is a connection with the Crusades and the Spanish Inquisition and all that, but that's again too much for this lecture. In return, they had to send the King of Spain a single Maltese falcon each year on All Saints' Day, which is Halloween, as payment. The decadent cathedral that stands today was built 1572, 57 to 50, somewhere between 1572 and 77. Nearly 400 knights who fell during the Great Siege of Malta were originally buried elsewhere, but then were buried in this structure. So founded in Jerusalem during the First Crusades, the Knights of Malta, the Sovereign Military Order of Malta, officially the Sovereign Military Hospitaller Order of St. John of Jerusalem, of Rhodes, and of Malta, was established. Their membership continues on today, It is a Catholic lay religious order and claims continuity with the Knights of Hospitaller, chivalric order that was founded about 1099 by the Blessed Gerard in the Kingdom of Jerusalem. And this would have a system of a Grand Master. So Blessed Gerard was a Benedictine priest who came from the city of Amalfi, and an influential city-state that grew in the wake of the collapse of the Western Roman Empire, which birthed modern mercantile capitalism. In the 9th century, Amalfi was a rival to Venice, and leading patricians of Rome had settled in both city-states that began to exert international influence over Mediterranean trade routes in the buildup to the Crusades. Amalfi was also a cult center and had gained control over the Isle of Capri, a hotbed of Mithraic and Sibylline cults built up by Emperor Tiberius and maintained as a mystery cult headquarters to this day, which is why so many celebrities and such go to the island still today and even live there. The official emblem for the city of Amalfi became the emblem for the Order of the Hospitaller Order of St. John of Jerusalem, Rhodes, and Malta. So the Templars were among the first to use the term Grand Master in reference to the commander of the Knights Order, but this, in fact, came from the Catholic Benedictine Order. And as we're going to see, the Benedictine Order pretty much gave birth to all of these Crusader Knight Orders. This is not something I'm going to read all, but it's just an interesting note that the Benedictine Order would create the Knights Templar, the Knights Calatrava, which is in Spain, which would have its origin with the Cistercian Monastery, which is also important, the Knights of Alcantara, the Knights of Montesa, and again, the Knights Hospitaller. So they all would come out of the Benedictine Order with a Grand Master structure. And it's also of note that the Jesuits also model themselves off of the Benedictine Order. So again, this is just to show what all of these are coming from, including the Dominican Order, which I won't have time to talk about today, and the Grand Lodge of Malta. The city-state of Amalfi had won its sovereignty from the Byzantine Empire in 839 AD and became the driving force of maritime commerce, while also becoming a center of mystery cults from 834 until the end of the Third Crusade. Amalfi was also owner of the infamous Isle of Capri. Additionally, it was Amalfi's leading merchants that arranged entry into the Holy Land through negotiations with a feeble-minded caliph as Zahir, who in 1023 gave them permission to rebuild Church of the Holy Sepulchre of St. John. So the logo of the Maltese cross is associated as the rival order of the Knights of Templar. So basically when the Knights Templar were abolished, the Knights Hospitaller or Knights of Malta took pretty much everything that they had in terms of their network. So the network was never abolished. And as we're going to see, the Knights Templar also arguably was not exactly abolished either. Is there anything else I want to add here? No. So in this map, it's a tourist map, so it's the hearts, but I wouldn't say it's as friendly as that. I mean, it's definitely beautiful, but you need to be careful with where you travel for sure. This is a map of the Amalfi Coast, and we can see the Isle of Capri, which is the hotbed of the Mithraic and Sibylline cults built up by Emperor Tiberius and maintained as a mystery cult headquarters to this day. And again, Amalfi is the emblem for the Hospitaller Order of St. John of Jerusalem, Rhodes, and Malta. And this would also take shape in other areas and has connections to the Mafia Brotherhoods, which again is too much for me to go into for this lecture, but they can refer to my Substack for all of this information through Glass Darkly. So the Knights of Malta, as well as the Masonic Order of Malta, which had a great influence in Malta, and later on, I have these circled Palermo and Corsica, because these would all be areas where you would have connections with basically the Knights of Malta Crusader Order and the Mafia Brotherhoods, and also Freemasonry and the Catholic Church. So there is a network with all of this, and the Catholic Church is basically, you know, at the head of this. The origins of the Mafia Brotherhood actually come in into Spain, and they were in service to the Spanish Inquisition from the very beginning, and would later be imported into Naples, which later they were imported into Palermo, and Malta would play a big role in that. Dun, 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 dun. And also to make a note that the Crusaders and later on the Mafia as well in more recent history would have control of all of the port systems. And this is also an important point in terms of having control over what would eventually form the black market, the black budget for drugs, weapons, trafficking, and so forth. So the Knights of Malta were actually one of the first. So when modern Freemasonry came about in 1717, Malta was one of the first to come about after Great Britain, the Netherlands, and France. An interesting thing too about these Knights of Malta was that Formosa Fremont is a big player. Who would be a member of the Knights of Malta, but he would also play a big role in shaping the Jacobin revolution in France. And Napoleon Bonaparte, who comes from Corsica, would also have an overlap with the Knights of Malta, and his family also has connections, obviously, to the Genovese rule and all of this. Again, too much to go over in just this lecture. So Pierre Mollier writes in his paper, who I believe is a member of one of the Freemasonry lodges, he writes, thus the Maltese Masons used a typical 18th century French Masonic structure. After the traditional degrees of apprentice, fellow, and master, the brothers used a series of those high grades that were the privileged channels of esotericism and the chivalric imagination in the century of enlightenment. These rituals were particularly fashionable in the lodges of southern France, particularly in Toulon or around St. John of Scotland and Marseille. Thus the Knights of the Sun, so again, recall what Matt had gone over in his class in terms of these gods of the sun, Helios, Marduk, Apollo, Lucifer, and so forth. They're all coming from the same source. And you would now start to find this connection in Freemasonry too, this reference to the sun. Thus, the Knight of the Sun uses an astonishing alchemical symbolism concerning the rosy cross, which appears as an attempt to restore primitive Christianity by emphasizing its initiatory dimension. So again, just a continuation of what Matt was talking about. This wasn't real Christianity, but it was a Gnostic form of Christianity that they were trying to bring about, a Gnostic interpretation. So Masonry was found deeply present in the Order of St. John of Jerusalem. Over two-thirds of the Knights of Malta membership were Knights of, the Lodge of Malta, Freemasonry Lodge of Malta. Two-thirds of their membership were the Knights of the St. John of Jerusalem, and the others were Catholic priests or often employees of the order. The Knights of Malta traveled extensively, and Freemasonry served also to link them to different power centers in Europe, where their commanderies in France, Italy, Spain, Austria, etc. were located. The Knights of Malta were also stationed in various Catholic courts. So even though the church was supposed to be against Freemasonry, it's very clear that that was not actually what was being practiced. And the Knights were employed in many national navies, either in the headquarters or the major ports. There were far more Knights of Malta across Europe than there were on the island. And you see this again in the 20th century with the kind of naval intelligence connections we had in the United States, and how they basically were in charge of giving back the Italian mafia all of its power after World War II. That was the US naval intelligence who played a role in that. So Pierre Mollier continues, a more subtle and even more mysterious motive further explains the presence of knights and lodges. Some showed a clear interest in Christian esotericism. We will not retrace the relations between Laurens and Cagliostro here. However, it is also unusual to observe the relative overrepresentation of the Maltese and lodges professing the rectified Scottish Rite. Yet the rectified Scottish Rite and its order of benevolent knights of the Holy City saw themselves as restoring true chivalry in service of the most essential mysteries of Christianity. Its structures were those of an order of chivalry. Its ceremonies and instructions were meant to explain the relationships between God, men, and the universe by the mediation of Jesus Christ and intermediary spirits. The Knights of Malta therefore practice a very distinctive type of masonry. And again, Matt went over this very nicely in his lecture, explaining how you have the exoteric and the esoteric elements, which is all about you getting to dictate the translation of meaning to different levels of your membership. And so truth is constantly being altered to suit your will. So the Gallican Church is a very big player. I don't know how many people are aware. This is the French Catholic Church, and it's basically the French expression of the Anglican Church, the Church of England. This religion is meant to serve the emperor and his dominion, and this was something that was organized under King Louis XIV, who he called himself the Sun King. And that he also liked ballet a lot. So that's him being portrayed as Apollo in the Ballet Royale. We actually have a professional ballet friend who realized that everything he was taught came from King Louis XIV's French occultism. He doesn't dance anymore professionally. King Louis XIV had established a similar cult. He was called the Sun King and had built a temple of Apollo in France next to the Versailles Palace on the model of Tiberius's temple at Capri. So this is a picture of Tiberius's temple in Capri, built at the beginning of the first century and discovered in the 1700s. A lot of weird stuff happening there, lots of sacrifices. This is a painting called The Orgy of Times of Tiberius on Capri by Henryk Cimarutski in 1881, featuring the fusion of human sacrifice and Bacchanalian frenzies of the moon. You can see the sacrifices to the left lower corner as they're in their orgiastic frenzy. Matthew Arendt writes in his paper, The Apennine Sibyl, Epicenter of World Occultism. Great paper, recommend people read it. The Isle of Capri off the coast of Amalfi, Italy, was given over to the Benedictine order in the 5th century, and which housed both the vast caves of Mithra and temples of Sibyl, where Emperor Tiberius, the uncle-in-law of Pilate, sorry, why did I say Pilate? Sorry, I'm a little bit brainwashed. Pontius Pilate hosted his orgiastic rituals, fusing the sexual frenzy of Dionysian and Bacchus at night mixed with the Apollonian rituals of the solar deity by day. So that's a quote from Matt. There's not really much left to the imagination of what the self-dubbed Sun King, King Louis XIV, had in mind in his inspiration from Tiberius for his own Apollo temple, which again is tied in with the Benedictine order, who were directly implicated with the Capri mystery cults and the Knights of Malta. The King Louis XIV would also bring back the modern Templars under the newly founded Scottish French Rite. I'll talk a bit about that in a moment. This is a fountain of Apollo rising from the sea in his four-horse chariot in the gardens of the Palace of Versailles, France, built during King Louis XIV. This is what it is considered to have looked like back then. So Peckthorne writes in his book, Secret Societies of All Ages, we read that several lords of the court of Louis XIV, including the Duke of Gramont, the Marquis of Biron, and Count Talard, formed a secret society whose object was pleasure. The society increased. Louis XIV, having been made acquainted with its statutes, banished the members of the order whose denomination was a slight resurrection of the Templars, end quote. In 1705, Philip, Duke of Orléans, collected the remaining members of that society that had renounced its first scope to cultivate politics. A Jesuit father, Bonanni, a learned rogue, fabricated the famous list of supposititious grandmasters of the temple since Molé, beginning with his immediate successor, Lorbinius. So what this means is that there was a Jesuit named Bonanni who, instead of saying that the Templars died off, but after the death of Molé, that there was actually a continuation of Grand Masters of the Templar line. And according to Hedthorne, it's a clear fabrication. No imposter was ever sustained with greater sagacity. The document offered all the requisite characteristics of authenticity and was calculated to deceive the most experienced paleologist. Its object was to connect the new institution with the ancient Templar. So it basically was a fake document to make the claim that whoever was, a convenient grandmaster within King Louis XIV's court would now be the claimed continuation of the ancient Templar order. To render the deception more perfect, the volume containing the false list was filled with minutes of deliberations at fictitious meetings under false dates. This is a painting commissioned, of course, by King Louis XIV himself, and you can see Philip, Duke of Orléans, his brother, who looks almost exactly like him. So it's, again, a similar thing that would happen under Napoleon later on. Napoleon would deny that he had any kind of Freemasonry or that he was a member of Freemasonry during his emperorship. And King Louis XIV would also deny this, but his brother, Philip Duke of Orléans, was actually directly connected, as we saw with the previous quote, in reinstituting this order with this false document claiming that they are the legitimate continuation of the Templars. And this is a painting that was commissioned by King Louis XIV to show his whole family as Roman gods. That was apparently the actual intention of it. Yes. So again, this is a quote from Hedthorne. This is interesting. Robert the Bruce. I actually liked him and I liked that movie at the time that I watched it, but it's actually, if Hedthorne is right on this, Robert the Bruce was actually a traitor. And makes sense since he did backstab William Wallace. So Hedthorne writes, tradition says that on the destruction of the Order of Templars in 1312, many of its members took refuge in Scotland, where they incorporated themselves with the Freemasons under the protection of Robert the Bruce, who established the chief seat of the order at Kilwinny. There is a degree of Prince of Rosecroix de Herodon, or Herodon, as it is called in French. This Herodon says an old manuscript of the ancient Scottish Rite is a mountain situated in the northwest of Scotland where the fugitive Knights Templars found a safe retreat, and the modern order of Rosecroix claims the kingdom of Scotland and Abbey of Kilwinning as having once been its chief seat of government, hence where the name comes from, Scottish Rite. Hedthorne continues, King Robert the Bruce endeavored, like other princes before and after him, to secure for himself the supreme direction of those associations which, though not hostile to the reigning power, could by their organization become the foci of danger. It is the common opinion that this king reserved for himself and his successors the rank of a Grand Master of the whole Templar order, and especially of the Lodge of Herodon, which was afterwards transferred to Edinburgh. So if this is true, then what happened was he backstabbed William Wallace, jeopardized the real revolution of the Scottish and the Irish, and made a pretend revolution, but was always in service to the British Empire, which again, you know, you have the French masonry, you have the British masonry. The British were the first to bring back the modern form of masonry. So Robert the Bruce did a false revolution while the whole time actually being a conduit for all of this sort of activity. And this is why you'll notice that in Scotland, you do have a lot of oligarchism, right? Like there was a lot of traitors who became very powerful and influential in Scotland. And this would be an explanation for that. Hedthorne continues, philosophy indeed began to insinuate itself into masonry, simplifying the rites and purifying its doctrines. Among the philosophic degrees then introduced, that of the Knights of the Sun is noteworthy. Its declared scope was to advocate natural in opposition to revealed religion. These innovation systems multiplied, and the order served as a pretext and defense of institutions having no connection with masonry, Kabbalah, magic, conjuration, divination, alchemy, and demonology were taught in those lodges. In 1766, the Baron Tushtudi, I don't know how to say that, founded the Order of the Blazing Star, in which ideas derived from the temple and the Jesuits were strangely intermingled. And I, again, I don't have time to go over this, but there is connections to the Jesuits and what would be the Jacobin instigation of the French Revolution, since, you know, there were many players within the French Revolution, but the Jacobins, which kind of like ruined it and turned it into a bloody massacre. The Jesuits have a lot of connections as well as the Dominican Order in this. Actually, the Jacobins named themselves after the Dominican Order. The word Jacobin existed as a reference to the Dominicans at the time. And again, if people want to know more of that, they can just refer to my Substack. So yes, after this betrayal, Robert the Bruce only strengthened the Scottish High Lords at the expense of the people, and it appears it was during Robert the Bruce's reign that we had the beginning of what would form the abominable Scottish Rite Order, an amalgamation of the French Templar Order and Freemasonry that would reinfect France and later go on to infect the United States, largely as a consequence of Napoleon's rule, which we won't have time to talk about in this lecture, unfortunately. The relevance of the theme of the sun within the Scottish Rite is an interesting one, especially since we have two French sun kings, King Louis XIV and Napoleon, who former was clearly drawn towards the god Apollo as his emblem, King Louis XIV. This seems to be also a reference to the Temple of Delphi with the priestess that Matt has already brought up for you, so you already know. The interpretations of the priest at the Apollo, the Temple of Delphi, was a way to control intelligence and to shape people's decision-making in order to fit an agenda and also to sabotage a lot of plans. And Apollo was part of what I believe, and Matt as well, an intelligence network that was connected with the Temple of Marduk in Babylon and also Horus in Egypt. And they were all operating and communicating with each other in terms of these intelligence operations. This is actually a clip from our documentary, The Hidden Hand Behind UFOs, episode one. So Hackthorne continues, Freemasonry in France was not without influence on the French Revolution. I'm not gonna read all of that. The Grand Orient was established in a mansion formerly belonging to the Jesuits in Paris and became a revolutionary center. Catholic ceremonies unknown in ancient Freemasonry were introduced from 1735 to 1740 in the chapter of Clermont. From that time, the influence of the Jesuits on the fraternity made itself more and more felt. The candidate was no longer received in a lodge, but in the city of Jerusalem, not the ideal Jerusalem, but a clerical Jerusalem typifying Rome. And again, in statues is seen the hand of James Lanez, second general of the Jesuits, the glowing picture of that universal monarchy which the Jesuits hoped to establish. Another important point is that there arose the rite of strict observance, which again came out of the Jesuits. And where is this? In 1776, there arose at Vienna a schism of the strict observance, the dissentients, who called themselves clerks of the relaxed observance, declaring that they alone possessed the secrets of the association and knew the place where were deposited the splendid treasures of the Templars. They also claimed precedence not only over the rite of strict observance, but also over all of Masonry. Their promises and instructions revolved around the Philosopher's Stone, the government of spirits, and the millennium. To be initiated was necessary to be a Roman Catholic and to pass through all the degrees of the strict observance. The members knew only their immediate heads. Freemasonry had been made the tool and fool of prince and priestcraft. So Napoleon would continue, the Gallican Church again would play a major role in establishing Napoleon as basically head of church and emperor of the world sort of situation. And it was his arch-chancellor, Combeferre, who was appointed the Grand Master of, you know, pretty much every single Freemasonic order that existed in France. So again, this idea that Napoleon had nothing to do with Freemasonry is a very different, there was actually a battle between the French Grand Orient and the rectified Scottish Rite, and they favored the rectified Scottish Rite. So it's not to say that everything about Freemasonry was bad at the beginning. It seems that the rectified Scottish Rite, it was entirely bad. And it did eventually completely take over Freemasonry in France under Napoleon Cambaceres' overview. And there's a direct connection between London and Charleston, South Carolina in the United States. This is where Albert Pike also has played a role, which when Matt began his lecture with. And so this network is very important, played a huge role in the Civil War on the side of the Confederates. The mafia was also fighting on the side of the Confederates, very interesting. And even the first mafia had the Maltese cross, according to newspaper press accounts. This model was for both King Louis XIV's Sun King image and Napoleon son of the Battle of Austerlitz. This model appears to have come from Julian the Apostate. So again, this is, Matt has already mentioned him, who ruled as Caesar of the Roman Empire from 355 to 360, and as Roman Emperor from 361 to 363. Julian would make Helios the central divinity of his short-lived revival of traditional Roman religious practices in the 4th century. And yes, you just hear here, a Venus temple, major cult centers in Rhodes and Corinthia. So Julian himself would write in his hymn to King Helios, "What I am now about to say, I consider to be of the greatest importance for all things that breathe and move upon the earth. But above all others, it is of importance to myself, for I am a follower of King Helios. And of this fact I possess within me, known to myself alone, proofs for more certain than I can give. But this, at least, I am permitted to say without sacrilege, that from my childhood, an extraordinary longing for the rays of the God penetrated deep into my soul." Sorry, just checking time. Yeah, so it was believed by some that in 361, Julian the Apostate resurrected the polytheistic paganism as the religious philosophy of the Roman Empire. He offered the Mithraic mysteries as a substitute for Christianity. Julian the Apostate would also attempt to build a third temple of Jerusalem, which again, as Matt has made an explanation for, has nothing to do with the actual religions of Christianity and Judaism. So now we're going to skip ahead and talk about the role of the Jesuits in Vietnam in connection to what we've just gone over. Vietnam would be submitted to French conquest in the 17th century upon the arrival of the Jesuit priests. These Jesuit priests formed the Society of French Missionaries, which included their business backers, which not only consisted of French imperial business, but business with the British East India Company. It should be noted that it was part of the Jesuit order's central function to deal in business matters in service to the Vatican and its five congregations within Italy, Germany, France, Spain, England, and America. This privilege was sanctioned by the Vatican in the 16th century by Pope Gregory XIII, who bestowed on the Jesuit company the right to deal in commerce and banking, a right they have made extensive use of to this day. For anyone familiar with the Templars, one cannot help but note the striking similarity between the two religious orders and their right to deal in commerce and banking. The Templars were known as among the first, if not the first, corporation, as we already said. So the Jesuits, this is actually taken from the site of the Jesuit order. They show here their provinces in Canada and the United States. The Society of Jesus is organized into five provinces or geographic regions, each headed by a provincial superior appointed by a superior general in Rome. That was taken today. This is still functioning. And you can see the emblem for the Jesuits in the top left corner are the 32 rays of the sun. Again, the sun always a continuing symbol. The Vatican has sanctioned this function to conduct business on its behalf to the Jesuit order, and they are beyond government prosecution from any nation. They're above national law and international law. They only answer to the law of the Vatican, which is essentially the law of the Pope. The City of London is another example of a corporation which functions above the law, in this case, an ancient financial center in the middle of London that has somehow justified its continued existence beyond British law and does not have to answer to the British government. This is again what the dope trade bank HSBC is in service to, which I'll say a little bit more later on. During the next two centuries after the French conquest of Vietnam, the Jesuit priests embroiled themselves in Vietnamese politics, eventually providing a pretext for military intervention. Featuring the rampaging French massacre of the cities, the Vietnamese emperor abdicated ownership of three provinces adjacent to Saigon. Soon thereafter, Vietnamese ports were opened to European commerce. Catholic priests were permitted to preach wherever, and France was guaranteed unconditional control over all of Cochin China. This is clearly how the French Corsican Mafia got there, got into this location for the heroin business in Vietnam, and would be later on a territorial fight between the Americans and the French during the Vietnamese War. Edward Lansdale would head this fight for the Americans under the pretext of the Saigon military mission, which began in 1954. So Vietnam was fought over for several reasons. One of them was over who would control the heroin channels. But as we're going to see, there was also something much, much more sinister that would happen in Vietnam, which again, the Jesuits play a very central role. In this case, it didn't matter to the Jesuits if the French or the Americans won. They would still have their influence one way or another. And we have to see that this was the creation of South Vietnam was a bulwark against Ho Chi Minh's Democratic Republic of Vietnam that was announced in 1945. Recall that, you know, Ho Chi Minh was fighting the Japanese fascists. Many of these Asian countries were fighting the Japanese fascists in hopes that they would no longer be colonies. Vietnam was still a French colony at this time. When Ho Chi Minh announced the independence of Vietnam, because he was working with the Americans and he was promised this, the French, within a few months of less than that, after World War II, one of the bloodiest wars in all of history, went straight into Vietnam to protect its assets. Here you see also, so Edward Lansdale was able to take over the heroin trade in Vietnam through the help of Lucien Conan, a French legionnaire who was very close with the Corsican Mafia and betrayed them. And Edward Lansdale was able to take over the networks with this intelligence. Claude Chennault was one of the major players who helped in transporting the heroin. Paul Helliwell is also another one. The catch transport, Air America, all these types of things were used for heroin transport. Anna Chennault is the wife of Claude Chennault, and she was the head of the China Kuomintang lobby. And I just want to clarify something for people because it says head of China lobby. People have to realize that during the World War II, China was fighting a civil war as well as fighting the Japanese fascists. And the civil war was basically being fought between Mao Zedong and Chiang Kai-shek. And Chiang Kai-shek was being backed by the American OSS in terms of its fight against the Japanese fascists. Chiang Kai-shek had actually frustrated a lot of American generals because he was really not interested in fighting the Japanese fascists and was more interested in winning the Civil War. And, you know, he's a typical warlord. He was known for burning down whole cities with the Chinese people inside, using excuses that, you know, the Japanese were headed that way. We didn't want them to use their resources. This sort of thing. Anyway, he eventually loses the Civil War and he takes his followers to the island of Taiwan, which you see here. And it was from that station that he declared himself still the government of all of China. So that's what the China lobby under the Kuomintang, which is the army of Chiang Kai-shek, was proclaiming. That's why they called themselves the China lobby, because there were two governments at this point, the Chinese mainland government and the government of Taiwan under Chiang Kai-shek. And Chiang Kai-shek called himself the government of China. So it's confusing, but it's a Kuomintang. So after the Opium Wars, people should also be aware that Britain, you know, fought the Opium Wars with China for their right to trade opium to China. And China lost those two wars. And as a consequence, Hong Kong became a colony for 99 years and was only given back to China in 1997, I believe. but it's still pretty much, it has a lot of colony characteristics to this day that are beholden to the City of London, which I'll talk about in a moment. And it also had Shanghai. Hence, the HSBC Bank, Hong Kong Shanghai Bank, was a bank that was created for dope trade, specifically dope trade. And Shanghai and Hong Kong were controlled by the City of London, the East India Company, for a very long time. And Hong Kong, there are still some problems with Shanghai, but especially Hong Kong to this day. One very clear indication of this is a bill, a Hong Kong bill, and it is printed by HSBC. The currency in China is in yuan, and this is a dollar bill for Hong Kong. And HSBC has the right to print one third of Chinese money. The other third is printed by the Standard Chartered Bank, another City of London bank. So two City of London banks have controlled two thirds of Hong Kong printed money. And then the Bank of China, which is the only Chinese-owned bank, has the right for the other one third printing of Hong Kong currency. So HSBC is considered a blacklist of foreign companies in China. This kind of gives you an idea of how much China does not still have a lot of control over what's happening in Hong Kong. And it's too much information to go over in this class, but people can again refer to my Substack that Taiwan and Hong Kong would play huge roles in what would be the heroin production corridors that would eventually become the Golden Triangle. This was again through the Kuomintang, Chiang Kai-shek, and there's tons of evidence for this. You can again look at my Substack for this information. So this was unfortunately something that was backed by the American OSS, among other players. What is this? This is so much history. Oh, right. Okay. So this is just to let people know that HSBC is still a major player in dope dealing to this day, including weapons trafficking and financing for terrorism. In 2012, there were a bunch of Senate investigations into HSBC, a huge, massive list of things that they were found guilty for, but it's one of these arguments too big to fail. And so they allow this criminal bank, which most of its business is criminal. I don't even know if it does anything legitimate, but it's apparently too big for us to do anything about. And according to the HSBC Anti-Money Laundering Director, Leopoldo Barroso, he believes that 60 to 70% of laundered proceeds in Mexico are coming from HSBC, according to a U.S. Senate report. So this is massive. There's also information of how the CIA have actually trained the Mexican drug cartels at Fort Bragg. Green Berets are unfortunately involved in a lot of this activity. I'll talk a little bit more about Green Berets in a moment. So again, this is the Golden Triangle, a product of the Kuomintang, OSS, which would later be continued by the CIA. And as we will soon see, the Vatican. This is just to again show you that Chiang Kai-shek, these are pictures of Chiang Kai-shek, except for the last one is his wife. Time Magazine and Life Magazine, and Fortune Magazine, were all owned by Henry Luce, who was in tight with Allen Dulles, the godfather of the CIA. So you can see, you know, Time Magazine is infamous for having covers of Mussolini and this sort of thing. Chiang Kai-shek was China's Mussolini. You can see how much he's favored by these types of people. Ho Chi Minh would write in his Declaration of Independence for Vietnam, which was the Democratic Republic of Vietnam. He would have written in the Vietnamese Declaration of Independence, quoting from the American Declaration of Independence, "All men are created equal. They are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. Among them are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." It goes on to say, "A people who have courageously opposed French domination for more than 80 years, a people who have fought side by side with the Allies against the fascists, the Japanese fascists, during these last years, such a people must be free and independent." And what he's referring to here in terms of fighting courageously against French domination for more than 80 years, The communists were not the first to exist in Vietnam. There was already a huge network of nationalist activity, you can say, anti-imperialist activity that was occurring already in the 1800s that was opposed to the French imperialism. So this is how the network of what would later on be the Ho Chi Minh's grouping did not just come out of the air. This was a continuation of networks and cadres, educational cadres, trainings, and so forth that came from the 1800s by the Vietnamese patriots who were fighting against the French colonialists. So again, Ho Chi Minh, what was his threat? It wasn't actually communism. His threat was, among other things, the heroin production lines, which were going to fund Gladio. I'm going to talk a little bit about Gladio in a moment, but it's basically in service to the secret army of NATO and the Vatican, pretty much. These are the people who would have the fascists who would also come and work for them overnight once World War II was won. So he threatened these heroin production lines. As we're going to see, Operation Phoenix was actually a kind of disgusting lab experiment that was put on the Vietnamese people that was later on going to be used in Central and South America under Operation Condor, and which is also now being used against the American people, the Western people more broadly, in terms of not just terrorist activity, but also Orwellian strategy, MK Ultra, Tavistock sort of thing. Actually, there seems to be a connection with Operation Phoenix and the Tavistock Institute, which I have to look into more. But it makes sense because the Jesuits were in Vietnam, and the Jesuits seem to be the fathers of the Tavistock MK Ultra techniques. Jesuits were known, they bragged that they could break anyone down in a month and reprogram them. So, in order to oppose what Ho Chi Minh was creating, South Vietnam was pretty much created overnight, a non-existent nation with no government, no tax system, no police system, nothing essential to a function of a nation. And they would select as their leader Ngo Dinh Diem. Diem was born into a prominent Catholic family, he has a brother who also entered very high level into the Catholic priesthood. His brother would become Archbishop of Hue in Vietnam and played a large role. His other brother would be his right-hand man in basically the Green Berets trained their army, and his brother continued those trainings as a sort of like death squads in Vietnam. So as the story goes for Diem's rise to power, he was in the civil service. Then he, denounces the Emperor of Vietnam, Bao Dia, as a tool of France, which he was, but they try to make a sexy story for him pretty much. And he's exiled in the 1930s and spends his time in Japan, the United States, as well as a Benedictine monastery in Belgium. Very interesting. So again, we see not only the Jesuits who are continuing to have a presence in Vietnam during this time, but a clear connection with Diem having been given some kind of training at a Benedictine order. And just to note, the Benedictine order, which produced the Knights Templar, the Knights Hospitaller, aka Knights of Malta, would, like Ignatius Loyola, the founder of the Society of Jesus, the Jesuits, 1,000 years later, Saint Benedict isolated himself in the sacred cave, where over the course of 3 years he went through his mystical experience leading to the founding of his new order. Ignatius Loyola would also have this revelation in a Benedictine monastery, Our Lady of Montserrat in Spain. So Colonel Fletcher Prouty writes in his book, then Diem arrives back in Saigon, June 26, 1954, meets Lansdale. 1 day later, and assumes office like a little over a week later. After an election campaign carefully orchestrated by the CIA and Lansdale, Diem became president of South Vietnam on October 1954. So, seemingly out of nowhere, Emperor Bao Dai selects Diem to become the premier in the Vietnamese government, the non-existent government just a few seconds ago. By the way, Baltai is a puppet emperor, and he actually lived in the Riviera for most of his life, and wasn't even living in Vietnam. It was Lansdale who would remain the closest American advisor to Diem for the first several years of the Vietnam War, and Diem had nothing essential to a nation, but he had a lot of resources for paramilitary tactics and Orwellian concentration camps. So as Prouty writes in his book, JFK, there was an organized through Lansdale Saigon military mission. There was a mass migration of over 1 million Northerners to South Vietnam that was bought and paid for by the CIA. This evacuation included a lot of Catholics, but a lot of other people, and they clearly instituted a paramilitary psychological campaign. A lot of these people did not leave voluntarily, but it was done as a way to make it look, you know, the Geneva Convention said, anyone who doesn't want to live under the dictatorship of Ho Chi Minh, we will allow you humanitarian travel to South Vietnam. So what did the Americans do? They allowed for 1 million Northerners to be dumped in Southern Vietnam with the promise that they would be taken care of, and they were absolutely abandoned. So, of course, these people were living in the forest, and they had to resort to banditry and crime, and the villages in South Vietnam were beginning to be attacked, of course. While this is happening, Ho Chi Minh eventually actually favors the Catholics from the north, and he brings them into his South Vietnamese government. And this is where you start to have these Orwellian tactics. So again, very interesting that the Catholics were playing actually a really prominent role in Orwellian tactics, not the communists. Yes, you would get names, the Orwellian titles that we would start to hear through Operation Phoenix would be things like Extended Arms for Brotherhood, Operation Brotherhood, Citizens for Training Camp, Strategic Hamlets, the Civic Action Program, People's Arms of Brotherhood, and White Dove Resistance Sisters. Yeah, so as we as Prouty goes through in his very useful book, the Operation Phoenix would start to go into villages in South Vietnam, and they were starting to say, this is how things are going to be done from now on. And there's a lot of experimentation. I can't really go into the details of it, but there was always, it said, there was a CIA under the guise of military as an individual who would come to these villages accompanied by a Vietnamese translator and a Catholic priest, always. So here you have the Special Air Service SAS insignia. This is the British, you know, basically what would become the role model for the Green Berets later on. Contrary to what we're led to believe today, the Green Berets were not a Kennedy administration creation, but in fact were a creation of World War II meant to mirror the British Special Forces, Special Air Service, founded in 1941 and reconstituted in 1950. They were part of the British Special Operations Executive, Churchill's Secret Army. And these secret armies, also called stay-behind units, later became part of NATO's secret armies and ran Operation Gladio. So, you know, again, when this was happening already during World War II, but when World War II was ended, there was a lot of terrorist activities that we only found out in the late 90s. There was a bunch of declassified records from the CIA, as well as other places on this. And Gladio was discovered to have actually existed. NATO had a secret army stationed all throughout Europe with different names depending on the country it was in. And their job after Stalin didn't actually invade Western Europe was to actually stage terrorism and false flag events, blame it on the communists in order to support far right-wing government. And they even assassinated a few people. Aldo Moro is a big name. And they tried to assassinate De Gaulle many times. And Kennedy's assassination ring is also tied to Operation Gladio, unfortunately. So the Green Berets, the US Special Forces, were created off of this mirror of Churchill's secret army. And they were basically rebranded. Eisenhower didn't want them, he wanted them to be kept asleep, you know, during his, because it was supposed to be a time of peace. They were never supposed to be brought out during a time of peace. And that was one thing that started to get compromised within the United States, is this idea that no, we should have paramilitary activities constantly, even during times of peace. That was actually one, at one time, a controversial idea. Now it's like, you know, no big deal. So the Green Berets were actually reawakened by Edward Lansdale. Edward Lansdale played a huge role in reawakening the Green Berets, and they actually played a central role in servicing his Orwellian projects in Vietnam. The reputation of the SAS, which was shrouded in infamy with their sensitive deployments throughout the world, including the training of Pol Pot's forces in the Khmer Rouge. SAS units were stationed in Northern Ireland, where Irish Republicans considered the SAS as nothing less than terrorists. There's a quote, "A very strong case can be made that even from a British point of view, the SAS were part of the problem in Northern Ireland rather than part of the solution." And this is a symbol for Gladio with the motto, "In silence, we serve freedom." In other words, cloak and dagger type activity. And of course we have the Gladio sword in both of them, and Gladio means sword, and this is again a reference to the Crusaders, and they're very aware that that is a reference to the Crusaders. Here's Orwell in the back row, third from the left, doing his police training in Burma in 1923. So Orwell would write 1984 actually off of his experience in Burma. He was actually a policeman interrogator, and I've heard a very nice theory, I agree with it, that his characters in 1984 were him identifying as the interrogator and the receiver of basically, you know, electroshock therapy techniques, right? This was the beginning of Tavistock, MK Ultra, and again, the Jesuits would play a huge role in this, and the SAS activity later on, the Green Berets, all carry this type of strategy program with them. Malaya is actually a really big one too, and was used as the blueprint for the Phoenix program directly. So it was Lansdale who created the Phoenix program. He had also created Operation Mongoose. He was also, you know, connected at Lemnitzer, who was at the time the head of the Pentagon, also did Operation Northwoods. You know, these kinds of false flag things were, in the case of Operation Northwoods, they were planning on attacking American military and citizens and blaming it on Fidel Castro in order to justify a war with Fidel Castro. So these are things that are still continued to this day. We have to be very aware that there's this very dirty game going on, especially right now in Central and South America, in terms of who's being blamed for what, which I'll talk about a little bit later on. So these OPC covert operations, it's a very benign name, Office for Policy Coordination, that was under Frank Wisner, who was the, you know, kind of right-hand man of Allen Dulles, the godfather of CIA, where paramilitary basically became the role, and the American government, Congress, the Senate started to have absolutely no idea what this branch was doing. And this was all in service to Gladio, which was never in service to the American people. It was about having control and all of these centers having a proper training of the kind that, of a government they wanted to see. So these people who started to go into these countries who were soldiers were actually part of reformation on all levels of education, economy, politics. This all became the job of Green Beret trained people. Do I want to say more? So most of the members of the CIA, at least the very infamous ones, are members of the Military Order of Malta. And again, you can see a very clear Crusader theme going on with all of this. So Lansdale would revive the Green Beret program. One of its major first major functions is would be in Vietnam. So this was the big experiment. And if you see the Phoenix is, you know, it's a bird that's known to go up in flames, and it's reborn again. And that's sort of an MK Ultra type idea of blank slate. You break something down completely, burn the village to save the village. that kind of idea. You break someone down completely, or you break down a whole society, a whole country down completely, and you rebuild them up into the image that you want to see them as. This was one of the first laboratories of Vietnam that this occurred in, which again, later on, became Operation Condor in Central and South America with the death squads that were being trained by Green Berets in Panama. Saying the US Army under the direct purview of the CIA in Vietnam would indoctrinate the next generation of recruits who are taught that it was their role to not only neutralize the enemy through such pacification programs. So this is the new generation of American military. They're taught completely differently from the previous generation. They were taught pacification programs like Phoenix Program to take part in a country's reform on all levels, including politically, economically, and culturally. This is what we saw as well with the Iraq War. Increasingly, anything that had to do with the policing activity would also fall under the purview of the CIA. Again, Orwell's police activity, he was a part of this this kind of model. This included the police activity within the United States as well, where Green Berets increasingly took over the management and directive of police forces within their own country, using tactics that were not for the increased safety of the American citizens. It was not long before the Army, Navy, and Air Force all had developed many units of special forces, which specialized in clandestine operations. Special air warfare squadrons and sea air and land teams. These were sent to any country that would accept them. These teams were heavily sprinkled with CIA agents, and most of their direction in the field was the operational responsibility of the CIA. The Phoenix program went international and was led and secured by special forces units modeled off of the British SAS in service to global empire. So I'm gonna jump a little bit into the past, but it's gonna make sense because I'm gonna talk about the Vatican. So something that's important for people to know is that in Italy, Italy wasn't a full country until like the late 1800s. It had many different warring provinces, and very notably, you had the Papal States. So the Papal States actually had their own military, and the Papal States were actually responsible for pushing the first crusades on Emperor Frederick II, who didn't even want to have anything to do with this. And it was, it seems, a peaceful first crusade, but they kept pushing, you know, this agenda. Italy was so pissed with the Papal States that by the 1800s, when they did get their independence and Italy became whole, they didn't eradicate the Vatican headquarters, but they did tell them to stay in their little box. And if they were to step out of that box, they were gonna have a reckoning. So from 1870 until Mussolini, this was the state of the Vatican, but Mussolini would free the Vatican. Here you have Benito Mussolini, Pietro Gasparri signing the Lateran Treaty in 1929, bringing the Vatican City into existence, but also giving it sovereignty, which gave it special status in law. It was Pope Pius XI who was Pope at the time. He seems to be an okay Pope from what I've heard, but Pope Pius XII, who came in March 2nd, 1939, was a different story. And in 1942, he would institute the Instituto per l'Opera de Religion, IOR, which is known as the Vatican Bank. And the Vatican Bank had basically special status. Again, very much City of London, it can do no wrong. And I just want to say, Paul L. Williams, who wrote a book, Operation Gladio, the Vatican Bank has actually been found in many, many scandals. It's been found responsible, but the Italian government and no other government in the world can hold them accountable. One of the biggest ones is the Banco Ambrosiano, which found 8 shell companies that the Vatican owned. And 6 out of 8 of them were in Panama. Panama is very central to all of this Gladio operation, which again is interesting how Panama is talked about so much in the news today in a, you know, not mentioning these things. But when these shell companies went bankrupt, it completely devastated the economies of Italy as well as other European countries. And the Vatican Bank was found guilty of this, and the Italian government and the Italian people were completely powerless to do anything. This is Paul L. Williams. He says, the IOR, the name of this agency, never appears on any balance sheet from all published reports. This ecclesiastical entity is non-existent, and the Roman Catholic Church survives solely as a hand-to-mouth institution. Because of its clandestine workings, millions can be deposited into the IOR on a continuous basis and channeled into numbered Swiss bank accounts without the possibility of detection. It was the perfect place for the CIA and the Sicilian Mafia to launder their ill-begotten gains of the narcotics trade and for the Roman Church to fund its political mission. And according to Moneyball, the Anti-Money Laundering Committee of the Council of Europe, it remains one of the world's leading laundries for dirty cash under Pope Francis. So I just have a few more slides nearing the end. So Kalergi is considered the spiritual father of what is the European Union today. Kalergi would write several autobiographies, and his one in 1943, he writes, the Kuttenhofer line, so that's part of his last name. The Kuttenhofer line reaches back to the 11th century when two brothers Kuttenhofer joined the First Crusades in 1099, where Jerusalem was conquered for the first time by the united armies of the Christian Knights of Europe. They had belonged to the oldest nobility of Northern Brabant, now a part of the Netherlands. At the end of the 18th century, the Kuttenhofers had been made counts of the Holy Roman Empire. Here you see in the top right, this is Kalergi's idea of this is the first one with Kalergi's idea for the sign of Pan-Europe, which is the Apollo sun and the Crusader cross. Later on, he would put the circles around it, and you'd see the European Union adopting this flag with the hidden spot, which I feel is, you know, sort of still referred to as a hidden symbol within the European Union flag. Kalergi would continue, I discovered to my surprise that the feelings of European consciousness had first shown itself during the Crusades. After the fall of the Roman Empire, the Crusades represented the most vigorous display of European solidarity. For a time, feuds between kings, princes, and cities were submerged in common cause. The first program for Pan-Europe came from, I'm not going to write about that or read that, but this league would have two objectives. First, to ensure permanent peace within the Christian world, and secondly, to rally the armed strength of Europe for the reconquest of the Holy Land and the Mediterranean. So again, back to this Kingdom of Jerusalem idea that Matt was discussing. So this is the continued impetus for where we're headed towards today. In the 19th century, it was Napoleon who first endeavored to unite Europe by force of arms. After his fall, the Holy Alliance created a pan-Europe of sovereigns for the prevention of wars and revolutions. And finally, in 1834, Mazzini founded Young Europe, a movement designed to coordinate all existing revolutionary movements with a view to building up new and united Europe on a basis of nationalism and democracy. But that what that really means is a League of Nations concept, with several empires all in service to the British Empire and everything else as a satrapy, and again, a mission for the Kingdom of Jerusalem. And we see that being revived today. And again, he says himself, Hellenism and Christianity, the cross of Christ and the son of Apollo, figured side by side as the twin enduring pillars of European civilization. So this is the second last slide. I'm just going to read two quotes from Prouty. Anyone who doubts that this nation building and police activity has not become real and very effective right here in the United States, and Canada is also implicated in this, need only visit the area of Fort Bragg to find one of these early paramilitary CIA-oriented specialists, General Tolson, sending his American soldiers out into the countryside with a nation-building program for the citizens of the United States. If such tactics, and it's again an Orwellian play, right? Obviously, nation building is fine, but they're using it from an Operation Phoenix program vocabulary. If such tactics continue, it is possible that an enlargement of such a program could lead to a pacification program of areas of the United States, such as the CIA and the US Army have carried out in Indochina. He goes on to say, in an effort to account for the success of its work with these refugees, the Saigon military mission declared its tactics to include psychological warfare. Today, we would more accurately call it terrorism. Is it any wonder that the program labeled communist-inspired insurgency that emerged in the South arose because this horde of displaced people, the Northerners who were dumped into southern Vietnam, were forced to fight for food, shelter, and the necessities of life? In other words, there was never a real issue other than the crisis that was manufactured. This is the way that the CIA and its sponsors made war in Vietnam. By late 1960, our forces had created the concept of counterinsurgency, the new modern warfare of permanent warfare. And just for people to be of note today in terms of all of the talk of Central and South America, the United States Southern Command is located in Panama, and its job is to protect the Panama Canal, but it is also the center of communication that coordinates activities within Central and South America. It was central in Operation Condor in terms of communication between all these different countries. It is where the death squads were trained by Green Berets as well. So we should be aware of these sorts of things. That's it. Thank you for your patience. I know that was a lot of information. Sorry.